move to the third case this morning, Crawford versus countrywide home loans.
Please, the court. I'm Kent Hall from South Bend. I represent the appellants, L.V. and Yvette Crawford. We appeal from the district court's decision granting summary judgment to one defendant and dismissing claims against the other defendants. I intend to address two issues as well as any other questions that the court might have. The first issue is whether or not the district court had subject matter jurisdiction under the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. That also implies whether or not this court has jurisdiction to hear the appeal. Secondly, the second issue is whether or not the district court erred in granting summary judgment in favor of, or the district court granted erred in granting summary disposition, both summary judgment and the dismissal. With respect to the first issue of subject matter jurisdiction, the appellee, which I will refer to as Bank of America Countrywide because that's who they are, says at page 12 of its brief that the issue of subject matter jurisdiction is a, quote, recent innovation raised by the appellant. In fact, we raised the issue to the district court both in briefs as well as in discovery, a contention interrogatory, and the district court, in its opinion, left very strong hints that the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine barred subject matter jurisdiction. Therefore, I believe that I have an ethical obligation to at least address that, and the conclusion I reach, based upon the recent ruling by the Supreme Court in the Skinner case, which we have cited in our reply brief, is that the district court indeed did have subject matter jurisdiction and that Rooker-Feldman does not bar subject matter jurisdiction, nor does it bar review by this court. The difficulty is that the district court cited a case called Fincher. I was the lawyer in the Fincher case, and I lost. In both the district court and this court, and the Supreme Court denied cert, I used the same arguments, more or less, which the appellee Bank of America Countrywide makes in this case. Therefore, for this court to conclude that Rooker-Feldman does not bar subject matter jurisdiction will require it, I think, to look at the Fincher litigation. Unless there are any questions on that point, I will proceed to the second point, which is whether or not the district court was proper in or was correct in granting summary judgment and summary disposition to the defendants. With respect to the Bank of America Countrywide position on the district court's grant of summary judgment, at page 24 of the brief by the appellee, it says that the issue is whether or not the summary judgment or the movement, that is Bank of America Countrywide, made a legally significant showing to support judgment in its favor. So the question becomes, exactly what was the movement's burden? As the district court said, this is put up or shut up time. What did the movement put up? Essentially, what it showed was that it had an affidavit from one of its own employees who said that she had looked at the file and she had concluded that there was no improper reason for the foreclosure of the property and for the actions which Countrywide had taken. our view is that under the Celotex decision and under the previous decision, the Atticus case, which we take the position that Celotex did not sub salento reverse Atticus, because the Supreme Court has continued to cite Atticus and this court has continued to cite Atticus. Our view is that the burden did not shift with that showing, also under this court's ruling in the R.R. Donnelly case. Because what did we show? Well, at pages 9 through 15 of our reply brief, we set out the affidavit that we used in the district court by Mr. and Mrs. Crawford. The court can obviously read it for itself and has probably done so.
Mr. Hulk,
yes.
Can you tell me precisely what you are asserting as your claim against Countrywide and Bank of America?
Yes, Your Honor. The claim essentially is that Countrywide was engaged in predatory lending and that the transaction with Mr. and Mrs. Crawford was illegal from the beginning and throughout all the subsequent efforts which took place.
And you're asserting this for what purpose?
We are trying to show, well, let me explain, that initially when I came into the case as the relief pitcher after there had been summary judgment granted by a state trial court in Indiana, we are permitted in Indiana to file under our state trial rule an independent action which attacks a judgment on various grounds under Trial Rule 60B8. I did so in the state trial court, and I also at the same time filed a simultaneous action in federal court. I filed in both courts at the same time. I did so because I was unsure, particularly in light of Rooker versus Feldman, which was the proper jurisdiction. We alleged, again, as we set out in the affidavit, that the characteristics of this transaction were classical predatory lending and that the plaintiffs were classical victims of predatory lending. They were elderly, disabled, minority, and poor. There was a flip in the assignment of the original mortgage.
Isn't that fairly standard in the industry, though?
It may be. Unfortunately, Your Honor, it is fairly standard, and that's why we have a foreclosure crisis. It's one of the reasons. I note yesterday, for example, the Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court has just, in this state, established a commission to investigate foreclosure practices by the courts and attorneys handling those cases.
The bottom line I'm really getting at is, aren't you really attacking the state court proceeding?
That is certainly part of what we were doing, Your Honor, and that's why I think there is a Rooker-Feldman issue. It has to be addressed. We are attacking both the lower court, the state trial court judgment, as well as the manner in which that judgment was enforced by the LaPorte County Sheriff, and what happened to the Crawfords in the eviction from their home.
Are you therefore saying that Rooker-Feldman doesn't provide a bar here?
Your Honor, with respect to Rooker-Feldman, the latest case, the Skinner case, indicates in the opinion, as I read Justice Ginsburg's opinion, that lower federal courts have invoked Rooker-Feldman too frequently. There are other cases which we cite, such as the Lucas case, in which the court has said, yes, there was a judgment involved here, but there were other issues involved, and therefore Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply. I think the message from the Supreme Court on Rooker-Feldman is lower courts are too frequently using this as a docket control device, and that's not what it's supposed to be. Now, if I may return to the issue of the summary judgment, this is, of course, assuming that the district court had jurisdiction. And I will say I am mystified that the district court in itself invoked Rooker-Feldman with respect to the countrywide motion for the Bank of America countrywide motion for summary judgment. But the other ruling, which was a separate opinion, earlier opinion, involving the LaPorte County Sheriff and the LaPorte County Commissioners and the lawyer who supposedly was representing them, the district court didn't invoke Rooker-Feldman. So I'm not sure why the district court was concerned in one case and not concerned in the other. I don't claim to be able to answer everything about Rooker versus Feldman, but what we have faced in this case, as I'm sure the court is aware, is a very fast-moving situation in which, as this case has proceeded, even since the district court ruled, we have seen numerous changes in enforcement actions and in the entire crisis which has been brought about by the mortgage foreclosure situation. I tried to get some of that before the district court. The district court refused it. The district court would not reopen discovery. I tried to get it before this court with a motion to take judicial notice, which was denied. I think I will stop at this point and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, if I may. I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Jerkowitz?
May it please the court, David Jerkowitz for Countrywide Home Loans. If you look at the plaintiff's complaint, you've got 22 counts that kind of cover the board of issues you could raise to a mortgage. And the district court did an excellent job of breaking down the specific facts in each of those counts and showing why Countrywide was entitled to summary judgment. On two of the counts, the district court raised the issue that Rooker-Feldman could possibly apply, but then found independent reasons for the judgment beyond Rooker-Feldman. If we go to the summary judgment standard, we've got a failure here by Crawford's to demonstrate under Rule 56 and the local rules in the Northern District of Indiana to properly designate evidence in opposition to Countrywide's motion for summary judgment. That is the specific basis for the opinion. Judge in the Northern District stated failure to follow the local rule and to designate evidence was the basis for the opinion. I could go through the 22 counts. I'm not sure that's a worthwhile endeavor for any of us. Suffice it to say, many of them, judgment was granted based upon, for instance, Countrywide was not a state actor. A number of the counts asserted claims that would only be fileable against a state actor. Other bases where there was no application of facts specific to the Crawfords to the law. And frankly, there is no specific designation of any facts that show how Countrywide's actions affected the Crawfords. The genesis of this was a foreclosure action brought in the LaPorte County Court. Gary Dilk was counsel for the Crawfords. He's one of the defendants. He filed an answer on behalf of the Crawfords, did not respond to summary judgment, and Countrywide was granted summary judgment in that action. Thereafter, Countrywide filed a petition for writ of assistance, which is the eviction action in Indiana. And the Crawfords, I believe Mr. Hall, filed a motion to stay that and an appeal. The LaPorte County Court did stay that action and required the Crawfords to make payments of $1,200 a month while the appeal was going forward. Crawfords failed to do that, and Countrywide precipitated the sheriff to proceed with the eviction. The claims and the complaints in this action really relate to post-foreclosure issues, post-judgment issues. You've got defendants such as the sheriff, who was not a proper party to a foreclosure action. The LaPorte County Commissioners had nothing to do with the foreclosure action. Mr. Dilk was counsel in that action, but not a proper party or defendant to the foreclosure action. So this ties into how Rooker-Feldman does not bar the district court's opinion in this matter, and how this court is certainly has subject matter jurisdiction to review the appeal.
Well, once the sheriff and the attorney were out of the picture, do you still believe that Rooker-Feldman would not have a consequence here?
Yes, Your Honor. If you specifically go through the 22 counts, they relate to the actions taken by Countrywide asking the sheriff to proceed with the eviction. So it's all post-judgment type activity that is the basis of the complaint. If Your Honors have any questions, otherwise I'm complete. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
It does work. Okay. With respect to the summary judgment issue, assuming the district court and this court have subject matter jurisdiction, the district court had fully before it facts which were designated. We had designated affidavits by reference, and in our submission to the district court, in our memoranda of law, the facts were set out. I'm not sure what the district court meant when it said we didn't comply with the local rules. The facts for this court are set forth in the reply brief at pages 9 through 15. That's what happened. I'm not going to repeat them. Why did we sue Gary Dilk, the lawyer? Because Gary Dilk was connected with an organization, as we alleged in the complaint, called Foreclosure Solutions, which took $900 from these people. Gary Dilk never talked to them, never met them. He entered an appearance in La Porte Circuit Court, supposedly, and they thought he was their lawyer, and he lost the case. They had numerous defenses. I will advise this court that Mr. Dilk is currently the subject of disciplinary proceedings before the Supreme Court of Indiana right now. Why did we sue the sheriff? We sued the sheriff because when the writ of assistance was issued... Well,
before you move on to the sheriff, yes. Can you tell us exactly what the contract or claim was with respect to Mr. Dilks? What exactly was he not doing in this case?
He was not doing everything, or he was doing nothing. What Mr. Dilk... Foreclosure Solutions, and I can advise the court that this is... a kind of entity, and an entity itself, which has been pursued now by attorneys general. When they learn that somebody is in trouble with a mortgage, they offer to come in and help. And in this case, and they solicited the Crawfords. They came in and said, we're going to help you, give us $900, the Crawfords paid. They thought Gary Dilk would defend them. He did appear. He did not resist the summary judgment. In Indiana practice, Indiana has a very strict procedure on resisting summary judgment. The next thing they knew, there was a summary judgment against them, and that's when they came to me. That's why I'm the relief pitcher.
So are you suggesting Mr. Dilks, this company, solicited your clients independent of the other parties involved on the defense side of the case?
I have no reason to think that Countrywide had anything to do with their choice of Mr. Dilk. No. I mean, the claim against Mr. Dilk is against him because of what he did or didn't do, and it's in this case because I need to put all of my claims together. I'm not saying there's a conspiracy between Countrywide and Mr. Dilk. We sued the sheriff because...
But it's a different claim. It's a completely different claim and completely different transaction, correct?
Well, it's part of the foreclosure proceedings, which Countrywide started. I mean, Dilk would not have been retained, if that's the word you want to use, if this proceeding had not started. We sued the sheriff, my last point, because when the writ of assistance was issued, I did everything I could. I called everybody in La Porte County to try to stop these, to work this out. Nobody would even answer my phone calls, return my phone calls. They went in with dogs when Mrs. Crawford
was alone. Sheriff, what did the sheriff do?
Personally?
Personally.
Well, the sheriff's, it was actually done by his deputies.
So there was no personal involvement of the sheriff in anything that occurred at your client's home when they went in to evict, correct?
As far as I know, that's correct, Your Honor. We allege vicarious liability.
So you're saying this is a respondeat superior or type situation?
Correct, Your Honor.
Even though the sheriff knew nothing about what deputies may have been doing at the home, except by virtue of the fact that he was the head of the office.
Well, he cannot escape full responsibility for what his servants and agents do. My time is up.
One more question. And your claim against the sheriff is under what statute? 1983?
It is under 1983. It is also under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
How does that come into play?
Because
with respect to the sheriff's department in this case?
The sheriff's department is a – I guess I can still answer, right? Okay.
Certainly.
Sure. Okay. The sheriff's department is a public service under Title III of the Americans with Disabilities – or under Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act, 42 U.S.C. 12181, 12131, excuse me. And the action by the sheriff, knowing her situation, violated her right in the way that they enforced the writ of assistance.
Thank you.
The court's attention.
We've got a little bit out of order, Mr. Jensen. Mr. Hull, I'll give you a couple minutes to respond to Mr. Jensen if you need to.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's all right. I didn't notice it either until just a minute ago.
I'm David Jensen. I represent Gary Dilk, and I'm speaking as well on behalf of the LaPorte County defendants. They were all subject to the order of dismissal on February 10, 2010, by His Honor Judge Simon. In the complaint that was filed on 29 May 2009, 2 days after the service of the writ of assistance, there are two references to Attorney Dilk. Both reference the fact that he represented the plaintiffs, the Crawfords, in the underlying mortgage foreclosure matter. No other reference is made with regard to Dilk. No allegations are made against Dilk with regard to any professional negligence at all. There is a reference in paragraph 16 of the first complaint that says all of the defendants breach contracts of which the plaintiffs are third-party beneficiaries. Nothing else was said. With regard to the second amended complaint, which was an attempt in part to add as defendant Foreclosure Solutions, which was denied by His Honor Judge Simon, Dilk is also referred to in that paragraph.
Paragraph 16?
In the second amended complaint, Dilk is referred to on three occasions, Your Honor. Twice with regard to his representation at the foreclosure, and then in the allegation of the complaint in which he attempts to allege a claim for relief against Foreclosure Solutions. That's in the second amended complaint. Again, paragraph 16 makes a general allegation that all of the defendants are liable for breaches of contract of which they are third-party beneficiaries. This was not a claim that was sufficient to withstand the motion to dismiss. There is absolutely no allegation of misconduct, legal malpractice, breach of duty with regard to Dilk. And so as a result, His Honor Judge Simon dismissed the complaint with regard to Dilk. With regard to the Board of Commissioners of LaPorte County, no claim was ever asserted against them except that they are an executive agency body with regard to the county. And no claim was ever asserted against the sheriff either. The events that gave rise to the filing of the claim on 29 May 2009 took place on 27 May 2009 When the sheriff's deputies came to the home, they came with a barking dog to serve the writ of assistance. That's the sole allegation there. Now, there is no allegation of liability with regard to the sheriff. No attempt to assert respondeat superior, which probably doesn't arise, and while they assert against the sheriff that he was acting under color of state law, which we believe would give rise to Monell liability, no claim for Monell is asserted, and in fact, with regard to the allegations in the complaint, the first pleading, the first claim, is a 1983 action, and notably, the only 1983 defendant in either the complaint or the second amended complaint is Countrywide. In other words, no claim is ever asserted under 42 U.S.C. 1983 with regard to the county or with regard to the sheriff. Then on appeal, we have absolutely nothing in the brief that draws the court's attention to the error that was committed by the district court. At pages 15 and 16 of the brief on appeal, there is simply a recitation of the fact that Dilk was the lawyer. Dilk was the lawyer at the foreclosure proceeding. But no further allegations are made except he got the ball rolling because the foreclosure was entered. With regard to the county, there's no allegation at all in the brief. With regard to the sheriff, the only allegation is that the sheriff is the sheriff, and then we recount what happened in paragraphs 18 through 20 of the complaint with regard to the barking dog and the writ of assistance. So here we have a quasi-judicial act subject to immunity, which is never pled around. There's no attempt to try to plead around the immunity that comes from serving a valid court order, because we know that's the case, because it's a part of the materials that were filed in support of the motion for summary judgment by Countrywide. So there is a complete failure to allege anything in this case with regard to either the county, the sheriff, or Dilk that could possibly constitute a breach of any duty. And if that's the case, how has Rule 8 been satisfied? When we come up on appeal, it is the same problem. We are never told in the rubric of Bell Atlantic or Ashcroft what it is that the misconduct was of each of these actors under the applicable legal standard that gave rise to an injury or damage to these plaintiffs. That's the problem. That's the deficiency. That's why the motion to dismiss was entered, and that's why, to be consistent with Rule 8, Bell and Ashcroft, the court should affirm, for no other reason than the fact that the brief on appeal doesn't even identify an error that was committed by the court below and how that error should be redressed under the applicable legal standards. Additionally, the reply brief makes no reference whatsoever with regard to the appellee's brief supporting the motion to dismiss. For those reasons, the order from February 10th, 2010, should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. And we'll give you two additional minutes to respond.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'm sorry for my misunderstanding of the line of argument. 2 points. Number one, if Rooker-Feldman prevents subject matter jurisdiction, the court could do nothing with respect to anything. It couldn't dismiss. So we've got to sort that out. It cannot grant a dismissal and then, if it had no jurisdiction, take any other action. Secondly, the allegations about the sheriff are set forth to the district court, and they are essentially reflected in the affidavit that I extrapolated and put into the reply brief. Exactly what Mr. Dilk did was clear to the district court. The district court erred in simply saying that he was not a state actor and that ended the question. I thank the court for its attention.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.